Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, in for Laura Knoy, and this is The Exchange. There have been several alleged sightings of mountain lions in New Hampshire recently. The big cat has been extinct, at least the eastern mountain lion has been extinct here, since the mid-1800s. New Hampshire's Fish and Game Department says there's no proof mountain lions live in the state, yet residents from Bedford to Berlin have been reporting sightings for years. Today on The Exchange, we discuss what residents may have been seeing and what breeding mountain lion pairs would mean for our ecosystem. Think you've seen a mountain lion? Let us know your story and share your photos if you have them. Email exchange@nhpr.org or give us a call to tell us your story. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Today on the program, Patrick Tate, New Hampshire Fish and Game wildlife biologist and fur bearer project leader. Sam Evans Brown, host of NHPR's podcast Outside In, which is about the natural world and how we use it. And Rick Vandepoel, naturalist and founder of Ecosystem Management Consultants of New England. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for being here. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
So I want to start the program with a comment from someone who is not in the studio with us today, Sue Morse, naturalist and science director for the organization Keeping Track. We'll hear from her periodically through the show today. She talked with us a little bit before the show about why the mountain lion is so compelling and why we want it to be part of our world.
The big cat really commands the utmost respect, not so much fear, but fascination, and maybe it's a no-holds-barred nostalgia for a better world, a wilder, fuller world, not a world that's constrained by, you know, our boundaries and our taxes and our highways and, you know, all that. It's a bigger and better world. And the cougar embodies that.
So a little bit of nostalgia, maybe, for a better world embodied in the mountain lion. I wanted to get your thoughts on the mystique of the mountain lion. Start with you, Rick.
Well, the mountain lion, of course, has been a sort of an enigma in the wildlife suite for years and years. And I have this great text, History of New Hampshire Game and Fur Bearers, and I think by Helena Silver, who used to work for Fish and Game, and she sort of iconized this animal in one of the quotes from 1892, stating that the catamount was the most ferocious of all the wild beasts of New Hampshire. His great size, strength, and agility of movement, together with his formidable weapons, rendered him the terror both of man and beast. And when provoked, no animal could stand before him.
Elegantly put.
Yes.
Thank you for sharing that. Pat, what do you think? The mystique of the mountain lion.
Mountain lion being a large predator, a cat which ambushes prey, animal that hasn't been known to exist in the state for well over 100 years, brings a lot of, for some, excitement, fear for others, and those two polarizing opinions on the situation is what I believe brings that mystique.
Mm-hmm. And Sam?
I take kind of the long view on this. You know, the North America had a number of large predator species when humans first arrived on the continent, the American lion, the saber-toothed tiger, and this was the one that survived. I mean, they're a survivor. They're the generalists that made it through both the arrival of, you know, the Clovis people with their spears and then the Europeans with their guns. So they're just a very resilient species, and they're pretty neat, and I think a lot of folks would like them to be around.
They make great mascots, at least. Well, let's talk a little bit about the terms, because mascots notwithstanding, right, that they're referred to with a lot of different terms, and sometimes they can be confused with a lot of different terms. So when we hear mountain lion, there's also cougar, there's wildcat, there's bobcat, which is not a mountain lion. Maybe, Patrick, could you sort of spell out the different terms, which are synonymous and which are completely different animals?
So cougar, mountain lion, catamount, and there's one other,
puma.
I think, puma. Yeah, is the same animal. It's mountain lion.
What about panther?
Panther, same animal.
Same animal.
Mountain lion.
A bit of trivia. Guinness Book of World Records says this is the animal with the most names. In English alone, there's supposedly 40 names for mountain lions.
It's
wow.
Interesting that you brought this up because I've had people report, I saw a catamount. Oh, you saw a mountain lion. No, I saw a catamount. I didn't see a mountain lion. And
those are not the same things.
They are the same things.
Oh, they are the same. See, I'm already confused here.
What I'm getting at is the public sees different names and thinks that they're different animals, but it's all the same animal. Now, a bobcat is a completely different species. What's interesting about bobcats is here in the Northeast, we have some very large bobcats. We actually have the largest subspecies of bobcat in the northern part of our state, which they can get up to 40 and over 40 pounds, which looks like an 80-pound animal to visually, and quite large. And sometimes I've seen pictures of those where it's the question is, what is that? Is that a bobcat? What kind of animal is that? And trying to figure out the little pieces to identify them. So I bring up the names of differences, but the appearances can be confusing for some.
Mm-hmm. And so a mountain lion is actually quite large, right? When you talk about a bobcat may be 80, 90 pounds, and then a mountain lion could be between 130 and 180 pounds. So, Rick's shaking his head, so Rick, no, correct me, please.
Yeah, 80, 90, no, that's a little bit outside the range of
bobcat.
That's
too big for a bobcat.
I think as Pat was saying, you know, 35 to 50 pounds on a male be reasonable range, whereas mountain lions, you're up to over 100, 110, maybe even 130 pounds on a big male.
Okay.
So one thing I'll add, what gets confusing is when you have a large adult animal and a smaller juvenile animal of a different species, you can now start talking about overlapping body weights and sizes.
Mm. And that will make identification for a layperson rather difficult, yes?
Yes.
Okay. Well, let's hear from Sue Morse again, a science director for the organization Keeping Track. She is renowned for tracking. Here she is talking about how to identify a mountain lion.
First and foremost, if you have color or if you can see details of color, look at the front of the face around the puma's muzzle. The muzzle itself is pure white, and then just up behind it, you know, at about 11 o'clock on one side and whatever that would be on the other side, it's black. It's got a smudge of black. And bobcats and lynxes don't have that. We don't have any other cats. The tail length is a giveaway, but not everybody gets to see the tail. But if you do, if you think you're looking at a wild puma, their tail is very thick, and especially in the winter, it's very thick and ponderous looking. It's not a skinny, rope-like tail like a house cat.
So, Rick, it seems like you agree that the tail's a big giveaway, whether or not it's a mountain lion?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Of course, like Sue said, you have to see it, and it's not always that visible.
Yeah, some of what she was saying sounds like it would require getting pretty close or at least having a nice zoom lens, right, Sam? Like pretty.
Well, I was going to say it's nice to hear about how to identify the facial markings, but probably being able to identify the tracks is probably the more useful tool that one could have in their toolbox.
Pat? So I'm not sure what subspecies of cat they're using to differentiate by those markings, but when she was describing the white of the face and the black, for me, as a person who's handled many bobcats and looked at many pictures of bobcats, the white chin, bobcat right off, is what comes out to me. And then the black, the ruffs on our bobcats sometimes have black fringes on them. So for me, as a person who's handled bobcats right off, I'm like, that's similar characteristics to a bobcat. The long tail, obviously, very different, but those facial markings were overlapping for me.
Mm-hmm. We mentioned that the eastern cougar and the western cougar, they were separate. Eastern cougar believed to be extinct. Were there any differences between these two that we could have noticed right off?
Well, I've never seen an eastern cougar, so I can't say when I've handled eastern cougars and whatnot. But having read a bit of information about eastern cougar, they were a darker subspecies. The western mountain lion lives in a more of a grassland open area and has to blend in with a very lighted situation. Here in the Northeast, we are a very shadowy, dark situation because of the forest. And our cats were a darker brownish, reddish color than what they were. And they were also smaller than what the Western mountain lion is.
This, when we talk about subspecies, this actually leads to an interesting tangent, which is that the field of biology recently has been sort of revolutionized by the use of DNA to determine what subspecies are. And there used to be this whole list of the different subspecies of mountain lion, and it has since been reduced to just two, the North American and the South American. Huh. And in fact, in 2011, when it was announced that the Eastern cougar was officially extinct, the reason that announcement was made is because they said, really, it never existed. There wasn't a distinct subspecies. The North American mountain lion is all one species. And then you can find a genetically distinct South American subspecies. So we toss these terms around, but really the term subspecies has been sort of redefined in our lifetimes.
So it's interesting, it's brought up, people have asked me about the genetics of Eastern mountain lions. So I did a bunch of research, and all the documentation I found was there are not any pieces of DNA of Eastern mountain lion. So for a scientist to do the lumping and whatnot, some argue that it's a leap of faith and that the Florida panther was more closely related to the Eastern mountain lion than the Western mountain lion was. So there's even debate about that very subject.
Mm-hmm. Well, is DNA the most reliable means we have of identifying whether or not what we saw is actually a mountain lion? Because, I mean, as we've heard in the past 10 minutes, like there's some disagreement or at least some vagueness about what an actual mountain lion should appear like in the wild, assuming we can even get close enough.
So one thing I'd say is DNA would definitely identify an animal as mountain lion or not. But before I go any further, I want to say we do not, New Hampshire Fish and Game does not test random scats.
Why not?
In the woods. We would be inundated with scats. Mm-hmm. In the past, when newspaper articles have been written about DNA and scats, I've had a number of people call up and say, I found a scat in the woods and I want a DNA identified. So the U.S. Forest Service Rocky Mountain Research Station has a database on mountain lion, and they can identify through DNA, the approximate area in the United States or North America where it was born, which goes back to the Connecticut cat and whatnot. They were able to ID all that by genetics. So here in New Hampshire, when a person turns in something that the department believes is possible mountain lion and believes it should be investigated further, we send our DNA samples to the U.S. Forest Service Rocky Mountain Research Station, and so far we have not had any positive mountain lion scats or any DNA.
Yeah, so that's more or less, I think, why I'm here and why I got into this. In 1999, I found what appeared to be a print of a mountain lion, and that was in the Ospe Mountains. And I thought, well, okay, that's a print, and it's not really strong. Let's look for other evidence. Less than a year later, I found a scat on the Squam Range. And I was working at the time with a fellow at the Michigan Wildlife Habitat Federation, Pat Ruse, and he was sampling, doing DNA samples from cats in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. I found a second scat, sent both to him. He sent those two samples with his to Wyoming. And unfortunately, Fish and Game Commission there did not get a positive read on it, but sent it back to Central Michigan University where they did a nuclear microsatellite DNA analysis and found no significant difference between that scat and other scats that were tested from the Rocky Mountain region. So that did it for me. As far as I could tell, there was a positive DNA sequence coming from this scat sample.
Patrick.
Yes. So I learned about what Rick just reported through a Heart of New Hampshire letter. I wasn't employed as biologist at the time of this situation that's being reported, but so I started digging into this report and spoke with another wildlife biologist with the agency and said, do you know anything about this? And they said, matter of fact, I do. I'm going to send you a letter that we researched this report and we spoke with those labs. And the lab wrote in their letter to us that they could only say that scat contained white-tailed deer fur and that they could not say what deposited the scat because it was far too degraded.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, we'd love to hear from you about mountain lion sightings. If you have seen one or if you think you have, give us a call. We'd love to hear your story. 1-800-892-6477 or send us an email exchange@nhpr.org. We're going to talk a little bit more about habitat first, but then we'll get into sightings. So give us a call now. We'd love to have you in the queue. Sam Evans-Brown.
I just want to say that the back and forth you just heard, I think, to me exemplifies why it's really hard to come up with positive, you know, 100% certain evidence that what you've got is a mountain lion. So here we have, you know, a very qualified biologist who found a print, took a plaster cast, found a scat, sent it to a university, and still the folks there weren't able to come up with 100% certainty what deposited that scat. So when we talk about the threshold of evidence required to say for sure you have seen a mountain lion, it is rather high. You need either a really good photograph, or you need, you know, fresh scat that can be sent to a lab out west that can be identified there. So I will just say this is a big reason why there have not been confirmed sightings, I think, is that the evidence required, first, someone's got to see one. They're very secretive. And second, the evidence required is you know, pretty tough to gather.
Mm-hmm. And so maybe before I go to you, Rick, I want to ask you, Patrick Tate, is the standard too high?
I don't believe it is. First off, if the standard for an agency to go forward with the public and put out a press release that the mountain lion's here, their believers are going to say, we told you they've been here the whole time. The non-believers are going to say, show us your evidence and show us, prove this to us. So for those reasons, I don't believe the standards are too high. The amount of game cameras out on the landscape to record images, department alone through contracts had over 150 throughout the state. Biologists go through various deer yards throughout the year, no evidence. And other states where mountain lions have turned up, there's always been physical evidence to prove those situations.
Like hair or fur or scat hair. Or prints?
Pictures of the animal, print, scat, hair, something along those lines. Mountain lions, when they show up, they leave evidence. They absolutely do. Somewhere, the way they travel, the things they do, they're going to leave evidence. So, and here we're talking about, in this situation, we're talking about a migrator from the West. If it's someone that has an illegal captive animal that is accustomed to humans, those leave a lot of evidence because they want to go around humans to find food, meaning they're used to being fed by humans, so they're not afraid of humans and they'll show up like a regular house cat.
Rick Vandepoel.
So I was a non-believer as well. I mean, that said, I lived out west for 9 years. I tracked cats in all the western states. I've collected scat samples. I've got several in my collection. So, you know, until I found those two scats, I didn't think that mountain lions were here in the east. The second one was not only fresh, but when I actually put my hand on it, it was, you know, smelled like cat. And there's no denying a fresh mountain lion scat if you can tell the difference between that and coyote. So it was no question in my mind. Second, when they did forward it from Wyoming to Michigan, you know, this was coming right from sample 18 and 19 had no remarkable differences from known mountain lions from Michigan or Wyoming. Now that, to me, seemed to indicate that they had done the secondary workup that, in my opinion, prove the existence of probably a disperser, possibly from South Dakota, like the one in 2011. So,
Sam.
So this cat's been referenced a couple times, and I think we should talk about it specifically, lay the whole story out for folks who haven't heard the story, because it's actually, I think, really indicative of a lot of the stuff we're talking about. So in 2011, a mountain lion was killed in a car accident in Connecticut. A car hit a mountain lion and killed it. The DNA that they were able to pull from the cat suggested that it was a dispersed mountain lion that came from out west. They tracked it all the way back to the Black Hills in the Dakotas. And so I think this is a really interesting story for a couple of reasons. One is that it proves what Pat was saying, which is that basically from New York State, where its trace was really picked up on a game camera around Lake George, all the way down to Connecticut, there was a lot of DNA evidence of that you could trace that was this same cat from point to point to point. But also, I think it proves the opposite point, which is that sometimes they're pretty secretive, because all the way from Minnesota, where it was the first time it was picked up on a game camera, to New York, there was no sign of it. They think it traveled north through Canada, across the Great Lakes, and then down again through New York State. And there's no evidence of that cat's movement in that entire 1,200 miles stretch of its journey. So I think in that story, there's something for the believers and the non-believers. The Mark Elbrock, who's a gentleman with the Cougar Network, told me this story as evidence that if they were here, we would know about it. But I've also seen it cited the opposite way, that look, hey, they're very secretive. It traveled all the way from Minnesota to New York without being seen.
Mm-hmm. Patrick Tate.
So I agree with what Sam said in part, that their ability to go undetected for an amount of time, but ultimately it was detected. So one thing that I find fascinating about this Connecticut cat, it was 6 months between the New York situation where they found evidence of it to when it was hit by a motor vehicle. So it's 6 months of a large predatory animal that moves great distances on the landscape, that it is not known if it went north, east, west, south, and how many circles it did. There's some information that suggests that it spent a portion of its time in Massachusetts near the Quabbin Reservoir. So with those ranges, it's completely possible that it may have spent time in New Hampshire and went undetected. But had it stayed in the area, ultimately, it would have been detected over time.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, we'd love to hear some of your thoughts on this. Have you seen one? Have you heard stories? Do you have questions about the mountain lion? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We'll hear more about the mountain lion's impact and the role it plays in the ecosystem. We'll also hear your stories if you have them. Again, phone number 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, in for Laura Kanoy, and today we're talking about the mysterious, elusive mountain lion with folks who know something about it. We're going to talk about sightings in this part of the program as well. We'd love to hear your story. When did you allegedly see a mountain lion? And I have to use that word allegedly because there is so much dispute about what people see and what they actually see. Email exchange@nhpr.org or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests today, Patrick Tate, New Hampshire Fish and Game wildlife biologist, Sam Evans-Brown, host of NHPR's podcast Outside In, and Rick Vandepol, naturalist and founder of Ecosystem Management Consultants of New England. So before we get into the stories of sightings, we're getting a lot of calls. We're going to queue you up and bring you into the program, listeners, in just a moment. But I want to ask about the role that mountain lions play in the ecosystem. We've been talking a lot about mountain lions traveling and being sort of hard to track as they move. Do they typically just move around a lot? Do they travel? We mentioned that one cat that was hit by a car. Word has it that it was a male looking for a mate. Is that typically what was happening there?
Exactly. I was going to bring that up. Juvenile males of almost all species disperse greater distances than females. So that's the specimen that you find going long distances. The females disperse a shorter range, and once they find a vacant home range, they stay in that location and live there. These young males are tracking, looking for mates. And if they don't find a mate, they just keep moving and moving and moving.
So if there were female mountain lions here, there would be more males just because that's what they're looking for.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. For all the men out there that don't realize it, women control our lives.
Well, and he would have stopped as well, I think, is the takeaway. Yeah. The reason that mountain lion kept moving is because he wasn't finding anybody.
Mm, okay. Rick?
And I would add that if a mountain lion male takes up residence and successfully finds a female, as Pat said, there's going to be a lot more evidence. There will be like deer carcasses up in trees and territorial marking and claw marks and tracks, and it you know, disperser is going to be very tough to see or observe, but a residential pair, that's a totally different story.
Well, and I think, and the last takeaway here is everyone, I think, probably agrees that any possible sightings that have been seen, that's what we're seeing, is dispersing mountain lions from the west who are just making their way through.
Yeah, and why would they? What is there something particularly hospitable about New Hampshire forests that make them want to come here, in theory?
It's a bouncing ball in a court, and it goes wherever the bouncing ball wants to go. There's no attractant. These animals aren't going with a map saying, oh, I want to go here. They're just moving around freely. Mm-hmm. So one thing I'll add, we're talking about natural dispersers, but talking with a conservation officer in the 1980s, they recall going to a residence, telling a person, you can live here, but your mountain lion can't. You need a permit to have that, so take care of this problem. I had a resident in New Hampshire tell me a story of a mountain lion in the 1960s where a person who would come summer in New Hampshire and then live in a different part of the country in the winter had a trailer that was housing his mountain lion. So nowadays, we think of this in the Northeast as crazy stuff that people would have a mountain lion as a pet. If you go on YouTube and search mountain lion pet, you can see people petting their 100-pound kitty like it's a regular domestic cat. So this whole illegal pet trade, black market pet trade thing does exist, and a situation like that can happen. So we're fixated on natural, but there's other possibilities.
Well, and in fact, Helenette Silver, in that sort of tome that Rick Vandepoel read from at the beginning, she quotes a biologist in Lyme, New Hampshire, who was keeping two mountain lions himself. So in the not too distant past, in the early 1900s, it was perhaps more common. And still in Maine, you know, you have to have a license, and it's hard to get that license.
License to own a mountain lion.
Yes. So it is possible in Maine to have one, but you have to be sort of professional handler, as it were.
Same here in New Hampshire.
Weird question, but do they make good pets? why would you want one?
Wildlife, from all the situations I've read and learned about wildlife, they're very loyal to the handler, which makes them very dangerous to everyone else.
Oh, okay. So maybe a good pet for you, but not for your neighbor if you just stop by unannounced. Okay. So let's go to the phones. Listeners, give us a call if you'd like, 1-800-892-6477. John is calling from Bennington. Thanks for your call, John. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you.
So what's going on?
So I've been telling this story for 5 years or so, and very few people believe me. But I was riding a mountain bike not far from my house. I live pretty much on the town line of Greenfield. This was a couple miles down in the Greenfield, early in the morning on a dirt road, county road, and all of a sudden a big cat jumps out of the woods over a stone wall, stood in the middle of the dirt road as I rode towards it, and I came to a stop. And it was, I've seen a lot of bobcats in my time, and I just came to a stop and was just sort of confused about what I was seeing. It was a really muscular-looking cat. I mean, it was at like a side angle to me. And I noticed it had a really big sweeping tail that kind of curled up behind it. But still at that point, because everyone says there's no mountain lions here, I got home to my wife and said, hey, Janice, you should have seen the cat I saw. It was a bobcat. It had this giant sweeping tail. And she said, John, bobcats don't have big sweeping tails. And the more I thought about it, the color of it, it was definitely not a bobcat. So I've been convinced the whole time that I saw a big cougar or puma, or whatever you want to call it, standing there in the road in Greenfield.
Well, John, thanks very much for the story. Really appreciate it. Sam.
John, if you're still on the line here, how far were you from this cat?
Probably 50 feet at the most. And it stood there just a second, and I came to a complete stop, and then it ran away.
And then it ran away. Okay, John, thanks very much. So, Pat, you field a lot of calls about people seeing or reportedly seeing mountain lions. Mm-hmm. Is this kind of a typical story?
So a very typical mountain lion report. And as a biologist for the state, that's a situation where if he said to me, what did I see? Well, I can't tell you what you saw. You saw what you saw, and I can record it as information, but I can't confirm or verify anything.
Let's go to Mike in Epping. Mike, thanks for your call.
How you doing? I saw the tail end of a, literally, from behind the shoulder to the long tail of a mountain lion crossing the highway going from Concord to Alton Village downtown, and I was probably about a half a mile from downtown Alton Village on the rise, and like I said, I saw the from behind the shoulder all the way through past the long tail, and it was unmistakable. It was not a bobcat. It had to be a mountain lion.
Convinced.
That was about 13, oh, absolutely convinced.
Yeah.
13 to 15 years ago.
13 to 15
and,
years ago.
Yeah, and what was really remarkable about the whole thing was I was maybe a half mile from downtown Alton Village.
Well, yeah. Well, let me ask maybe Pat and Rick about this. Any sense of whether or not mountain lions are sort of wary of more population-dense areas like the one he was describing, Rick?
Well, I'd report that, you know, as John Harrigan up north has in Coos County for about 15 years, I kept track of reports and people would call me and tell me where they saw the mountain lion they thought they saw. And it varied right from, you know, downtown villages all the way to remote highlands of the North Country and everywhere in between. A lot of times, I mean, there was this one lady I remember in Tuftonboro. She was having a garden party on her back porch, and everybody in the party saw this mountain lion cross the field down below the porch.
They reported seeing the big tail and everything?
Everything. And it was, you know, 10 or 12 people saw it all at once. Mm-hmm. So hard to refute. If there's no interest in making up a story, which many people, of course, do, then I would respond the same way as Pat did. I can't tell you what you saw, but it sounds like a mountain lion, but no proof was offered.
We get this emailed comment from Michael. He writes, "As a farmer, I come across many outdoorsmen looking to hunt our property. I had a conversation with one who believed very strongly that we had mountain lions in New Hampshire. He told me that on one of his many scouting trips for black bear, he found a deer carcass up in a tree." So Michael follows with the question, do we have native species that could have exhibited this type of behavior, leaving a deer carcass up in a tree? And the second question, is this a behavior mountain lions exhibit? Rick, I believe you did mention that they do leave carcasses up in the tree from time to time. But are there any other species known in New Hampshire to do this on a regular basis, Pat?
Humans.
People leave deer carcasses up in trees?
I've had hunters hang deer carcasses for baiting wildlife in trees. I've actually had to walk in on one or two now and look at what was going on and figured out what was going on. So, yeah, as far as wildlife species that put deer in trees, no, there aren't any others that I know of that put deer in trees.
Just humans might be responsible for that.
Yep.
Well,
yeah.
And this might be a good moment to talk about hoaxes, right, which I think Pat and I have both experienced. We did a short segment about mountain lion sightings earlier this year, and after which I was sent a photo and also a video recording that was mostly just audio because it was so dark. The photo, just a quick reverse Google image search, you can put images online and see where else they've been posted, revealed that the photo had been taken out in Wyoming and has been used, you know, hundreds of times to claim. And the person who sent it to me said it had been taken in New Hampshire, but clearly it had not.
So you're saying, like, hoaxes, people who claim to have seen a mountain lion but knowingly have not or are appropriating photos taken elsewhere of legit mountain lions, say out west where they people acknowledge that they exist.
Certainly, knowingly or unknowingly. In this case, the person who sent it to me said, "Hey, a friend of mine sent me this photo and said he took it on his back porch." Also, but I mean, the video I had been sent was, you know, a recording of a animal growling, but it was in slow motion. And when I asked the person, "Why is this in slow motion?" they denied that it was. So there's a lot of weird stuff that happens in regards to people claiming they've seen these things.
Well, I want to ask Patrick Tate about one of these stories. A few years ago, you had a story about someone who claimed to have a photo sort of dropped onto the SD card of a camera he had set up out in the wild. Can you tell us about that story?
Yes. The report came in from a conservation officer. "Can you look into this picture? I have it reported down in the Keene area." I looked at the picture and he asked me, "What do you see in the picture?" And I wrote back, "Mountain lion. This picture of a mountain lion. Will the person meet with us? Can we go out to the site?" And the great thing about pictures isn't the animal itself, it's the background. So you want identifiable backgrounds. If it's just in the middle of a green field, you can't prove anything. Had great trees behind it, beautiful ferns on the ground. So he brought me down to the site, and the ferns on the ground matched. We had six copies printed out. Each person had their own copy, and now it was identify the trees. The species of tree matched. However, the scarring on the trees did not, and the angles were off. It became a very interesting investigation over time because it started becoming, people were calling the New Hampshire Fish and Game Director's office saying, why are you dragging your feet on this? We want answers. What's going on? And of course, you know, things flow downhill. And I was pushed to go investigate it more and met with the individual two or three times. And there was a bunch of inconsistencies about the photograph. And as the biologist who's going to stand on this, and if I'm going to say this is a proven picture, I need to be able to stand on it soundly and have the evidence. So I got to go through it with a fine-tooth comb, kept picking pieces apart, trying to answer these pieces. Anyways, after 3 weeks, I finally found the image online on a Field and Stream photo contest. And the explanation in the end was the person had set the camera out with another individual, and they believed that someone who knew the camera location saw the similarities, put the picture on their SD card so it looked like that camera recorded the image.
That's pretty elaborate.
I have one that's more elaborate than that.
Wow. So they do get pretty involved. People go through great lengths to create hoaxes like this. Rick, your thoughts?
Well, absolutely, there are a lot of folks out there who, for some reason, need to create something that you know raises a stir and gets the attention of the media, et cetera. I actually have been interviewed a couple times by reporters, and with all due respect for the media, you know, facts aren't always communicated correctly. You know, one of the biggest questions I have about that is it points to how much we don't know. And if, in fact, we don't know enough, is there a way we can learn more about these dispersing mountain lions that may travel through the Granite State? And that I would ask certainly Pat about whether or not, A, he's spending too much time chasing down these kind of false leads, or B, would rather be doing something else that is more informative to whether or not we actually have or can prove that we have dispersing mountain lions in the state.
Yeah, well, what do you think, Pat? Do you get a lot of these things that end up being hoaxes?
I would say, well, when social media first started, they picked up. The hoaxes became much more prevalent. In the last 4 or 5 years, hoaxes have died down completely. I don't see the hoaxes anymore at that level. So it doesn't happen as much anymore. However, if and when it does happen, it takes up a lot of resources looking at that situation and identifying what's going on. Because when you start out, you don't know it's a hoax. You don't know what's going on. You gotta treat it as if it's a sincere situation.
We got an email question from Robert in Epsom who asks, are sightings or encounters with these big cats less dangerous here where they're passing through than out west where those same mountain lions might be establishing territory? Rick?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, I think it's there's a lady, Holly Ernst, out in California who has done a lot of the genotyping of mountain lions in Northern California, the ones that, of course, most people have heard about, taking down hikers, bikers, et cetera, and territorial animals are much more inclined to create a problem with passerbys than dispersing animals. In fact, I'd be totally shocked if a disperser would encounter with a human purposefully unless it had already had some type of training to do so.
Listeners, give us a call if you have a question or a story of a sighting, 1-800-892-6477. Let's talk to Mike in Webster. Mike, you're on the air.
Thanks. Good morning. Yeah, I had an experience last fall, so this was in around September, and I was driving from Webster into Concord on Horse Hill Road, and anybody in the area would know I was right near the Red Barn, and all of a sudden, this animal jumps out of the woods, and it bounded across the road in about two giant leaps and stopped in the field just on the other side. And my gut impression was almost greyhound-like, very muscular, large back legs on it, and the coloration on it was almost an orange, brownish-orange color. And so I stop and I look at the thing in the field, and as the animal looks at me, the face was very chiseled, definitely not a bobcat. I mean, there's no doubt. I've seen bobcat, I've seen them stuffed, I've seen them in the woods, and that was not a bobcat that I was looking at. So I reached down to grab the camera and look back, and like a ghost, it's gone. Ugh. I mean, it had just left that field and was out. You know, I'm like, seriously, I can't get a picture of the thing. But what an incredible sighting. And, you know, I called in the Fish and Game, and they immediately, you know, sent me to a website to look at all the bobcat pictures that and they asked me about the tail, which I just did not remember the tail. You know, out of that whole experience, I cannot recall or see the tail in my image of it. So what a neat experience. No doubt in my mind it was some sort of a lion, mountain lion animal.
Well, Mike, thanks very much for sharing your story. Really appreciate it. Let's talk to Bob in Laconia. Bob, thanks for calling.
Hi.
Tell us your story.
2 years ago, Jeff?
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Hello? You're on the air. Tell us your story.
Okay. About 2 years ago, I was at the Laconia Airport on the way home from the airport, and there's a lake on one side called Lily Pond, and then there's the Lily Pond Road, and then there's a 6-foot-tall fence. And I saw a huge cat about 4 feet long from nose to tail come across from the water across the road and just leap over a 6-foot perimeter fence in a single bound. And a lot of people around Laconia Airport have seen it. A lot of pilots coming in have said they saw a huge mountain lion or cat running across when they were landing or taking off. And it seems like it's been there for like 4 years or so.
Okay. So well, thanks for sharing. I want to put this to Patrick Tate, who may have heard some info from listeners like you about these cats. What do you think, Pat?
So I just got to throw a little interesting side note in this.
Okay.
That location they just described, we had 2 or 3 bobcats radio collared on the just off the runway
near the Laconia Airport,
and they were using all the habitat. So I just throwing that out there. It's an interesting.
He did mention 4 feet nose to tail, which would be kind of small for a mountain lion.
So,
right?
Well, a juvenile, 4 feet,
not a juvenile, I guess.
If you went nose to the base of the tail for a juvenile, that wouldn't be small at all. It'd be well within there. So, I just brought up the bobcat thing because the location is fascinating to me. That location, we have bobcats existing, but that location we have a mountain lion report because it's a developed area. And which brings me back to earlier, what I had said, it's a bouncing ball. They don't know the direction they're going. They just end up in these places. So I certainly can't dispute anything they said. There's no evidence for me to go by to verify or say what my thoughts are on the situation. It's, you know, I recognize their report. And
Sam?
Yeah, so I just had 2 thoughts, which is that we hear a lot of these stories. I think all of us here have heard these stories. And to anyone listening, I would just say, you know, Fish and Game wants proof, right? So do what you can get to do what you can to get proof. So try to take photographs if you see something like this. Perhaps poke around where you saw it and see if you can find a track. And that's how you can go from a story that Pat says I have nothing to say about that to a story that you know could be the first verified sighting in over 100 years. Just one more note about this danger question. Even when you look at the states that have extant populations, stable populations of mountain lions, attacks are relatively rare. So I would put this in the category of sort of like shark attacks, right? So they're scary. They get a lot of media attention. But compared to the amount of times that a mountain lion could attack a person but doesn't because they don't typically view us as prey, interactions are pretty unusual.
Worth mentioning if we're scaring anybody exactly. With this discussion of mysterious mountain lions lurking perhaps in someone's backyard. This is The Exchange on NHPR. Today we're talking about the mysterious, elusive, majestic, mystic mountain lion. And we want to know your stories if you have them. 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange@nhpr.org. We'll talk about conspiracy theories when we come back.
Hi, I'm Annie Ropeek, environmental reporter here at NHPR, reminding you that your fellow Granite Staters depend on NHPR as much as you do. Teachers and truckers, painters and politicians, grads and grannies, they turn to NHPR for the same reasons you do. News you can trust and journalism that is fiercely independent. Your gift, combined with those of your friends and neighbors, is the energy that keeps NHPR strong. Give now at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and today we're talking with folks who can tell us about the mysterious, elusive mountain lion and whether or not it is actually here in New Hampshire. Give us a call if you have a question or comments or story about perhaps seeing a mountain lion here in New Hampshire. The number 1-800-892-6477. So, promised a discussion about conspiracy theories. Sam, I wanted to ask you a little bit about that first and then turn to Patrick Tate of Fish and Game. We hear that there is allegedly a government conspiracy to deny the existence of mountain lions here in New Hampshire. So I guess a local government conspiracy. Sam, what's the incentive for the government to deny, allegedly?
Well, first I'm gonna sort of explain why what the theory is, but then also throw a bit of cold water on it because I don't think there's much logic behind it. But essentially, it's that if Fish and Game were to acknowledge that there was a population of mountain lions in the state, there's a chance that something like a listing under the Federal Endangered Species Act might happen, and then there'd be, they'd have to put a plan in place to protect the species. There'd be, restrictions put on development. There'd be all sorts of, basically a lot of hassle required if that were to happen. It doesn't make much sense because, mountain lions are, as we said before, there's just one subspecies of North American mountain lion. It's listed as a population of least concern.
It's not an endangered species,
no,
even if it were here.
No, there are populations in specific states. So the Florida panther is an endangered species. That subpopulation is, in fact, listed under the Endangered Species Act. But if you were to get western dispersing mountain lions just sort of expanding into New Hampshire, there's no logic for why they'd be listed as an endangered species. So I don't understand really how this idea came to be, but it is the main reason why folks believe that Fish and Game is covering up the fact that there are mountain lions in the state, again, with no evidence.
What about the idea of tourism? Like, leaving aside the fact that it is not on the Endangered Species Act, are the powers that be worried that scary mountain lions will scare off people from camping in New Hampshire?
Certainly that is a thing I've heard, but again, you have to think of the incentives involved here. You've got biologists, right, who are trying to make their way in the world, make a career. If you were the biologist who confirmed a sighting of mountain lions in the state, that would be very good for you. Like, you would be all over the news. So I the idea that there's some sort of downward pressure from the bosses saying don't tell about the mountain lions because it'll scare away the tourists, I just don't understand the mechanism for how that would happen.
So Patrick Tate of Fish and Game, no downward pressure on you to deny the existence at all costs of mountain lions here in New Hampshire?
No downward pressure at all. I think actually if one turned up and we found the evidence, there are a number of people who would finally say, finally, we can put this debate to bed. We have evidence. And as biologists, we would find it quite exciting to find that evidence of one in the state. So there is definitely no downward pressure by anyone.
Rick, your thoughts?
Well, just that I have evidence, and it was denied by Fish and Game at the time. And I don't need to prove to anybody that I saw one, just like some of your callers said, well, okay, I believe I saw one, that's fine. And I'm not looking for any media story, but I do think that it's appropriate that a Fish and Game agency would recognize verifiable proof if they could.
If I could just say one thing. Fish and Game didn't deny the evidence. Fish and Game looked into the labs to have them confirm the information in the reports, which the labs did not. So what I'm getting back is the verifying and confirming of evidence that was not there.
Mm-hmm. So let's say, Rick, that it was confirmed that there are mountain lions here in New Hampshire. We've met Fish and Game's burden of proof. I mean, so what? What is the practical change that it would bring to New Hampshire, if any?
Well, education is the real important thrust of what all of us do as biologists and game managers, and to make sure that, things like what Sam was saying, that in spite of what you believe, the mountain lions will not eat your children, they will not steal your pets from your backyard, and they will not necessarily be seen by you unless you're extremely lucky. So the whole media hype about how scary mountain lions are should go away immediately. And that would be, I think, the major thrust of educating folks about these casual dispersers.
Oh, Sam, go ahead.
Just one quick point. I think when we talk about these conspiracy theories, the real story is that Fish and Game is an agency that is short on budget and staff, right? And so the idea that they can follow up on every individual sighting is just crazy, right? So many of them are false sightings. There's a lot of photographs that you can see that it's very clearly a tabby cat that someone has thought was a mountain lion. And so with their limited staff and limited budget that is more and more limited every year because, you know, fewer people are buying hunting and fishing licenses, that's the real story, is they can't follow up on every one of these sightings.
Let's talk to Ron in Ware. Ron, thanks very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, guys. How you doing? I just want to tell you a story that my wife and I saw a mountain lion. We live around Cold Springs Campground, and it was undeniably a mountain lion. It was in the spring / kind of early summer. And my wife looked, and she goes, look at the size of that cat out there. And we were up in the second-story window, so we were about 30 feet away from it. And it came out. We could see its head, and we could see its long, swooping tail. And, boy, it was big. It had to be at least 200 pounds. This thing was huge. And it just made a little bit of noise, and then it was gone because I tried to get a picture of it. So it was definitely, we looked up all the pictures, and it was definitely not a bobcat or anything else we've seen. It looked just like a mountain lion. So I know it's another unconfirmed report, but you string enough of these together, I would say that there's going to be the truth in here somewhere. And so just wanted to share my experience with you guys, and it was pretty awesome to see if you get to see one, albeit it was in the brush. I just saw the head and the tail as it was leaving.
Well, hey, Ron, thank you very much for the story. Really appreciate it. Love hearing these stories. Let's go now to Kyle in Keene. I believe Kyle Jarvis from the Keene Sentinel?
Former reporter at the Keene
Sentinel. Former reporter, okay. But you've done some reporting on this, yes? And you want to share what you learned?
I have, yeah. Good morning, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I was at the Sentinel as a reporter there for about 4 years, and during that time, I probably wrote close to a half dozen stories or so on this topic, including a lengthy feature at one point that in which I spoke to several people from around the Monadnock region who claimed to have seen mountain lions at one time or another. And, you know, it's rather interesting because certainly there are those who it's a case of mistaken identity, or they wanted to see something that perhaps they actually didn't. But my experience was that the majority of these accounts could not be taken lightly. These were normal, everyday folks. Some of the reports that I looked into that were actually on file at the local Fish and Game office were even from people who did not live locally. They lived perhaps elsewhere in New England, and they were just passing through and happened to have an encounter of some sort. And really, whenever you hear a tawny coat and long rope-like tail, it's kind of hard to pin this sighting on any other creature rather than a mountain lion. There's just nothing else that really matches that description. Mm-hmm. So that was interesting, I think.
And Kyle, before you continue, I think Patrick Tate, just give me a second, Kyle. I think,
yeah,
Patrick Tate wants to jump in here.
One thing. Patrick, I recognize your name. It's good to talk to you.
Nice talking to you, too. So one thing I'd point out is we've been talking about situations with no evidence. A number of them come in with photographs. And with a description of the animal they saw, and by the way, I got a picture of what I saw. Here it is. This is where things start breaking down. So I get pictures with this great description, and one of my favorite stories is I had a great description with the witness. And then so I called the witness and wanted information from them, and the person says, what are you talking about? That was a bobcat we saw, and I have a picture of it, and I'll send it to you. They sent it to me. And it was indeed a bobcat.
Yeah.
So that's, for us as an agency, that's why we always go back to the physical evidence to support what they're reporting.
Absolutely. It's unfortunate that kind of thing happens as often as it does. I would just suggest that in my experience as a reporter covering this issue for a few years at least, at what point you know, do we reach a certain critical mass, for lack of a better term, of accounts where, and not to suggest that you guys aren't taking this possibility seriously, I think that you probably are, but along the lines of the conspiracy theories, as you mentioned earlier, there was a bit of a sense on behalf of what I'll call the pro mountain lion community, who felt that Fish and Game, maybe not even so much in a spoken policy, but maybe sort of an unspoken policy, did not want to find themselves in a situation where they had to spend money to create a management plan and so forth. Now, again, I don't know that there's anything to that, but on the other side of that coin, there is this sense that there have been so many sightings locally, and you guys, Patrick, you might recall the name Linda McCracken. She kind of turned herself into a local authority. I don't know if authority is the right word, but she was very dedicated to this. I don't know if she still is. I hope she's listening. And she had spoke to a lot of different people, ended up having a couple of sightings of her own without even, sort of by accident. So I think the point that I just want to get across is that there is a very strong sense locally here in the Monadnock region that there is some sort of mountain lion population. How large it is, how extensive it is, all of that remains unanswered, but it is an extremely interesting question, and I've really, really enjoyed listening to this program, so thank you all very much.
Well, Kyle Jarvis, a former reporter for the Keene Sentinel, thank you very much for calling in and sharing your perspective. And to his point, Patrick Tate, I mean, yes, we haven't met the scientific burden of proof here in New Hampshire as far as physical evidence is concerned, but is there room at Fish and Game for a kind of an informal nod to all of the people who have somehow convinced themselves and possibly some others that, yeah, there may be occasional sightings here?
So the individuals can say that, but for an agency that's based on science and whatnot to go off with no evidence and then get into that giant debate and all these other issues and put credibility at risk, I don't think that'd be a great path to take.
Well, Patrick Tate, New Hampshire Fish and Game Wildlife Biologist, thanks very much for being here this morning. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Rick Vandepol, naturalist and founder of Ecosystem Management Consultants of New England, and Sam Evans Brown, host of NHPR's podcast Outside In about the natural world and how we use it. Really appreciate you guys being here as well.
Thanks for having
Great.
Me.
Great. Thanks.
And listeners, this has been a lively conversation. We're sorry we didn't get to all the emailed comments and the phone calls. Your stories are appreciated, even if we didn't get a chance to hear them today. But you can continue the conversation on Facebook or at our website, nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brindley is our program manager. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. And our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.